silly. I mean, I want to emphasize, I don't think that's at all a large or important part of him. I mean, manifestly, Bauer would never have been an intimate friend of mine. I mean, temperamentally too different.
Do you think there are other cases in which the kind of width or breadth or catholicity of Isaiah's judgment as an intellectual has been limited or impeded or slightly distorted by Oxford commoner and provincialism?
Yes, I think so. I do think so. I can't give you another example off the top of my head. I'd have to rummage around, but I think so. I think that there are persons, again, I mean, who I think, you know, have to be taken very seriously, who somehow seem to disappear too quickly because of they aren't somehow the right shape. Now, Isaiah, in principle, of course, knows that perfectly well, because he's always talking about, you know, unhandleable geniuses, persons it's quite impossible to get on with, and so on and so forth. And of course, I don't believe, I would want to distinguish what I'm presently saying from the very serious sort of Scruton-like charge that this is a person who's compromised the intellectual life very radically by a pursuit of social success, which you yourself answered in a very friendly and appropriate manner, referring to his gifts for friendship and so on, that seemed to me absolutely right. But I'm not saying that. Obviously, I'm not. We wouldn't be having this conversation if I thought that. But I think that the sort of thing that a Scruton might mistake for what he's talking about is something about that you just well expressed, a certain kind of Oxford provincialism, as it seems to me.
And then the substance of the charge is not merely provincialism, but that he values a person's human clubability over much. He values it often at the expense of a genuine estimate of their intellectual qualities and contributions, and there is therefore a risk that a savage character, difficult character,
right,
of undoubted talent will be neglected by someone or misestimated by someone like Berlin because he...
Well, it's not misestimate. Yes, I mean, the cases I was referring to, they certainly were simply misestimated. I mean, he seems to me to have wrong beliefs. I mean, in the sense that, for instance, his remarks about Frankel would be of an entirely external character, no doubt very distinguished scholar, you know, but I mean, it obviously means nothing to him at all. Sometimes it seems to me that the misestimate in a way, a purely intellectual estimate isn't wrong, but it doesn't have the effect on his life that it should, or his own sensibility isn't affected by the farouche or the untidy or the awkward, or above all, and of course I plead guilty too, to some degree, by the boring. Particularly the self-importantly or generally gracelessly boring. And he's softer on clubbable bores, actually, interestingly, than unclubbable bores. Interesting example is Quine, you see. I mean, Quine is a clubman and a bore. Also a horrible man. Now, Isaiah sort of knows he's horrible, really. But actually, it's not, he quite likes him as a kind of another college figure. Well, actually, a lot of people do. It's not a very exceptional case, but it's an illustration of this same point up to a point, I think. I think it's connected with something about him, actually, which I think is very important to him. I mean, this is we're talking at a shallow level here, but I think this leads as a thread running from this to something that goes much deeper. Which is I think is a rather obvious fact about him, namely his fascination with the persons with whom he contrasts himself. I mean, his fascination with dark, irrational, religious, reactionary, dangerous, unhandleable, creative figures.
Demestre
and Dostoevsky. Above all.
I'm surprised you include Dostoevsky, because I find there a simple revulsion. I mean, I don't want to... a sense that really is unhandleable for him.
Well, I think you're right, but I think the fact that he he keeps, it seems to, you rightly write something more precise. I mean, the case of de Maistre, because de Maistre, after all, had the apparatus of, as it were, French argument about him, which makes him, that enables Isaiah, as it were, to get his hands on it more. But my feeling is that he's casting of himself as having what some people thought, in particular what Dostoevsky thought, were the negative aspects of Turgenev. And his sympathy for Turgenev, as somebody who thought people thought was too civilized, too liberal, too disposed to run away, and all those things, seems to me constantly. It's like, you see, when I said the thing about Verdi and Wagner was typical, that this constant talking of the shaping of Verdi was a shaping against the unmentioned counter-image of Wagner. The shaping of Turgenev is a shaping against the unexplored counter-image of Dostoevsky, that the importance of talking about all that is given by the idea that there is something enormously powerful, important, significant, which somehow, not indeed, doesn't want to get into, that's quite right, but is conscious of that very fact, as it seems to me. And this must have, again, something to do with what we were talking about, the silliness about the Nazis.
Where should we go here? There's so many lines I could follow you. We could follow, but perhaps we should just follow the issue of the Jews, because I think it does lead us somewhere.
Yes.
Interesting. I want to get a more precise sense from you of why he's silly about the Nazis.
Yes.
In what I sent you. And what is the proper account of the Nazis that he's failing to confront in his political philosophy?
Well, I think this is in danger of sounding tidier than I think it is, but it's a little neat, but, you know, you can abstract from that, I'm sure. I actually think they're a kind of... sort of three strains in it, actually, and they're different from one another. And let's just put them down. One is about being Jewish and the Holocaust. One is about evil. And one is about social explanation. And I think they combine in this matter, not surprisingly, since it's another highly charged matter. The Jewishness seems to me connected with this. He thinks it's extremely important. Jewishness, I mean, because that thing is obviously frightfully important to him. And whether somebody is a Jew is very important to him. And he's always referring to whether one's a Jew or not, or whether people are Jews. And not being a Jew, but sort of where I occasionally think people are Jews who aren't. And it always produces absolute incredulity from him. I mean, the idea that anybody could think this goy person was you must have had the same experience. Jew, must have been drinking. That's how a lot of this goes on. So it's very important to him and his connections with Israel and everything. However, he's obviously manifested by his entire way of life and everything. He's an assimilationist Jew. And like many assimilationist Jews, he regards particularly politically active Orthodox Jews with alarm and fear and distaste. I think that goes along with the idea that while being a Jew is interesting and important, the idea that it is for all time special, set apart, is repugnant to him. Now, many discussions of the Holocaust and interpretations of Nazism are clearly based on some such conception. And the historian struggle, I mean the recent controversy, obviously to some degree turns on the issue of whether this event is somehow absolutely special or not. One, Isaiah wants to say, and has explicitly said, that it isn't absolutely special. He wants to say that without betraying the Jews. But in his own mind, it can't be. To say that can't be a betrayal of the Jews, if you see what I mean, from the Jewish end of the question, because one reason that people have for saying it's absolutely special, namely, roughly, Freddie Raphael's reason for saying that it's absolutely special, is because of the absolute specialness of the Jews. And so there's a denial there, I think, which is tied up. That's the first reason. The second reason for thinking that it's absolutely special is you think because it's absolutely specially evil. Now, this can be thought in a religious dimension. Now, he doesn't think that because his view of history is secular. And for a Jewish person, it's very secular. Because part of the rejection of the specialness of the Jews is a rejection also of the specialness of the Jewish self-understanding of history, namely that it could be religiously redemptive or meaningful or teleological in the religious sense, which obviously it rejects. But I think with that, and perhaps even in association with it, or perhaps on more general grounds, he seems to me to also very resistant to the idea of evil in history, even in a secular, I mean, if you accept the idea of a secular sense of evil, where evil is just a shorthand for a certain ethical categories about irrationality, sheer destructiveness. And I think that goes back to the issues about relativism, which we might get on to later, about the notion of the, as it were, the gesunde Menschenverstand. I mean, the idea that there is a kind of human normality which is part of the fabric of history. And he is resistant to the idea that there is a kind of human normality which is so awful that... But while he's resistant to it, it falls into the category of what we were talking about earlier, that it's part of exactly which, the presence of which he's always conscious of. And hence, of course, the fascination of it in the case of de Maistre, where it can be handled because it's presented in a theoretical form. The idea that people... I mean, what he finds much harder to handle, obviously, is where such notions are presented not in a French theoretical form by a mildly dandified French reactionary.
But in the SS.
In the SS, or in the works of Dostoevsky. I mean, where it is made concrete, if you like, or real in imaginative terms. Similarly, when it's made concrete in the rather different terms, precisely as you say, of the SS. And that's very resisted, I think. Now, a third reason, which comes to the third point I was talking, is this, that if, suppose that you resist even a secularized category of evil, and you say, then you have to say, well, the Nazi phenomenon needs an explanation. And if you're against the, you know, negative divine incursion into history or inexplicable wellings up of human destructiveness, except you don't like that, then you've got to look for something explicable, which of course the Marxists used to do. I mean, in terms of the last expressions of capitalism or so on, you know, well known. Well, none of that's frightfully convincing, but as what we've actually got of that sort. But what is clear about it is that to provide such an explanation would be to use, to some degree, the categories of sociology or some related social science. Because, you see, you can't do it entirely by history. If you do it entirely by history, then you're going to end up into another sort of religious or ethical category again, because you're going to start talking about the Germans and German history. And why is German history so peculiar? Well, you're not, as it were, going to have given a guarantee that that is going to be a secular and non-racist explanation, unless it's got some theoretical apparatus to mark that point. If I just say, well, there are certain facts about German history, the unification of German history, that it happened so late, that the industrialized... But then, you see, I've got to start saying something about industrialization, or the nature of industrialization, to make that stick, without us just being stuck with the wicked old Germans and there they go again kind of thing, you know. That it's, as it were, the explanation of the Nazi phenomenon is heavy industry plus being German. Well, that's, you know, forget about it. So you're going to be getting into something which, even if it isn't a Marxist explanation, certainly not a Marxist, but some explanation which is going to use the categories of industrialization and so on, certain aspects of the German middle class resentment, the relation of the traditional German upper class to an emergent bourgeois class and things, and rentier class and so on. You're going to start saying these things. Now, Isaiah hates all that. because his impatience with the social sciences, in particular sociology, as we all know, is very considerable. And indeed, I would say that was another little bit of Oxford parochial silliness to some extent. I mean, I don't think his argument... I mean, we can all produce a posteriori argument against sociology, and some of us in a better position to do it than others. But Isaiah's arguments really are against the possibility of the social sciences are actually not, as a matter of fact, very interesting. I mean, they don't contain any very powerful intellectual consideration.
And they then produce a weakness in, for example, the Demest argument, which, by making Demest a kind of avatar of totalitarianism, produces intellectual history of a very dubious kind. I mean, it's overly intellectual.
Yes, that's right.
Explanation of origins, and it turns a kind of early 19th century Sardinian ambassador into some kind of, you know, angel of death. As
yes, quite true.
Doesn't quite work.
But it's nice and romantic. It's nice romantic consideration.
Yes. But that, in your view, springs from a certain view of social explanation.
Yes. I think that's right. I think he thinks that all social explanation really is either historical, in a very generous sense of historical, or the history of ideas, or psychological.
But then, to return to this business of what's silly about his view about the Nazis, it can't surely be the case then simply that social explanation is a missing piece here. Even when you've got social explanations abundantly in place in the Nazi case, you're still left with why individuals did what they did.
Oh, of course, yes.
Faced with other human beings, and then you're back into the problem of evil. And
yes, that's not quite what I'm trying to say. I mean, the point is that you don't have to be silly about the Nazis in saying that you don't understand what happened. In fact, quite a non-silly thing to say about the Nazis is that you don't understand what happened.
What's silly is to say, I understand.
Yeah, what's silly is to say... Well, what is particularly... What I picked on as being particularly silly was to say that the Nazis were a combination of a universal, well, not universal, but very widely spread, recognisable human belief, which, as far as it goes, is perfectly admirable, plus false beliefs about the Jews. Now, that's ridiculous. I mean, it's obviously ridiculous, because it first of all, leaves out... Well, I mean, it's obviously ridiculous. I mean, the point is, the idea that racism is a matter of empirical error is just dark, because where does that empirical error come from? You know, I mean, it's just absurd. And also because it's quite wrong to see patriotism or love of country as a category which can be operated at a level of generality in which both Verdi and Himmler are examples of it. I mean, by the time you get to... I mean, no doubt Himmler was in many ways a patriotic man, but the relation of... And it's not a simple pun to call both Verdi and Himmler patriotic, but the role that any such patriotism plays in the explanation of them, and the role that their psychology plays in the explanation of their patriotism, is so different in the two cases that you said simply nothing if you say that. That's what I'm getting at as being silly.
Well, that then takes you directly, if I'm following you, to this recurrence in Isaiah's view that there is a kind of set of propositions about human nature
certainly.
That provide us with a kind of stable basis for a liberalism that would avoid the relativist.
Yes, I think that's right.
To say we can recognize in Himmler, in Verdi, certain common properties of quite normal order.
That's right. Universal human passions, as you so far were saying.
And your point about that is that they are being specified at such a level of generality that they entirely miss what is quite distinct and separate about Verdi and Himmler.
There's two points. Well, that is one. That's absolutely right. I mean, the trouble is that the specification of the universal human passions is always runs into the problem that it, at the level at which it's true, it underdetermines the phenomena to the point that quite a large number of pieces of relativism are still left in place. In fact, also, if I could put in a slightly kind of postmodern consideration that is not his favourite meat and drink, as it were, namely that, as some of us would say, the very constitution of manifestations of those universal human passions is itself a product of what you're trying to explain. I mean, you can construct it as another example of, you know, love of parents. But the fact is, I mean, rather as any anthropologist will tell you in Anthropology 102, incest isn't, though it has a common meaning, it isn't the same social phenomenon in ancient Egypt, Tahiti, or wherever, you know. So in the same way, you'd want to say love of country, love of even one's relations and so on, isn't, though much in common, isn't the same phenomenon, because part of its construction, you know what I'm talking about. I mean, but actually the interesting thing is Isaiah wouldn't, because he would... I think that's partly... No, it isn't. I was going to say it's partly a generational matter, but it isn't the entire generational matter. It's a temperamental matter, whether you like that sort of thought or not. But even if you allow... there's one point we've just made, namely that these passions are not actually univocal. But even when you allow them to be univocal, they're so highly general that much remains to determine. There's also a third point, is that one of the universal human passions is missing. I mean, not one, but a set of them is missing in the universal passions of mankind, as far as I can see. I mean, occasionally gets referred to, but is not part of the substance of it. That is the desire for destruction, the desire for power that takes the form of destruction. Resentment.
Which precisely, de Mest specifies so brilliantly.
Of course, absolutely. And of course, a writer, needless to say, for whom you really cannot bear at all, namely Nietzsche. I mean, one of the great differences between us intellectually is the fact that I'm constantly interested in and become increasingly interested in Nietzsche. And it's not a subject that he and I would have anything much to say about. I mean, he just regards the whole thing really quite unacceptable. I mean, he knows enough to know that what he commonly said about Nietzsche, I mean, Nazism, anti-Semitism, so on, is false. But doesn't interest him. And insofar as he thinks it's either clever, just merely clever, or repulsive, or both. Now, that doesn't even fall into the class of what I said earlier about Dostoevsky, namely that he's aware, he knows about it, but he's afraid of it. He just... I don't regard it as a necessity on anybody to have to take Nietzsche seriously. I mean, I don't think it's... it's not one of the writers I put in the class as saying that it's simply a mistake to think that it's of no interest. I mean, it's a question
but
of...
this is not a matter of writers, one way or the other.
No, that's a matter of temporal.
Whether a philosophical view based on universal human passions is missing some key...
That's right, absolutely it. And so, I mean, to summarise it as if I was sort of giving a little kind of notebook on it, I mean, I would say the trouble about the view is that it, as it were, ignores the construction of the passions and how far they're univocal, and it ignores their highly general... an undetermining feature, and it ignores one of them, or a group of them. I mean, and that's a bit damaging. But of course, the point...
Then how damaging? Because I'm very struck as I listen to Isaiah's view of the liberal premise, or liberal set of arguments, is that he puts, given his emphasis on the practical difficulties of reconciling conflicting views, the fact that people will be attached to different values, the fact that, in his view, there are monsters about. It's a liberalism with a fair room for inevitable forms of coercion. I mean, I teased him to the effect that the hangman plays a pretty large role at the end of the day in his view,
yes,
as it does in Demest.
Yes, that's right.
May have a apparently sunny and slightly overly optimistic view of universal human passions, but the liberalism that then gets ground out is not especially sunny, and is rather, in its defense, could be said to be quite realistic about the possibilities of mutual human malignity.
No, I agree. I agree about that. I'm not saying that what he is a fatuous optimist. I mean, fatuity is not, as it were, the problem. No, that's not the problem. I quite agree with you. And, of course, like many conservative liberals, to that extent, he's rather pessimistic. You're quite right about that. And he's resigned and rueful and a lot of things of that sort, which is, of course, absolutely right. I mean, a correct description. No, the costs seem to me to be twofold. One is intellectual. That is, that his actual representations of human history can seem thin or illuminated only by sunlight. Not because the dark forces aren't there, as I've already said, they are there, but that he operates a lot of time with his back to them. That is, that the way they're working is by pushing him along a contour when he's not looking at them, really. So that they're present in his work, but they're present either in the form simply of acknowledgement or by exclusion, as in the Dostoevsky-Turgenev kind of case.
But is that fair, given as you say, that his whole post-war intellectual life was devoted to taking the romantic challenge to all that Enlightenment optimism seriously? You have the De Maistre essay at the center of it. Is it quite fair to say that he's kind of got his back turned to this stuff? There's some sense in which he's trying to take...
He's trying to take it on.
Seriously.
He's trying to take it on, you see, but I think the trouble is that comes to the second point, is that either it... I mean, he sees it as a challenge, but he sees it as a challenge to a view rather than the substance of the problem. I mean, he addresses himself to Romanticism because, as I said, I mean, my view is that he is fascinated by the forces which, in a way, his view doesn't allow enough for. And I mean, as I am to some extent, in the sense that because I know that my natural temperament is of a rather argumentative, rationalistic bent, I've always been interested in irrationalist writers and phenomena. I mean, that's one of the, in a sense, that's one of the similarities between Isaiah and me. But I suppose I'm a bit blacker about him, about them than he is, actually, in some ways. And it may be also easier for me to be blacker about them than it is for him.
Why?
Well, because he's Jewish, and because he's an émigré, and because his country, which his first language came, has been living under a hideous tyranny for almost his whole lifetime. And that seems to me to make it a bit harder. I mean, you know, you have a larger thing involved in your life than I have. I mean, it's just as a suburban English boy who Germans dropped the bombs on, as it were, and otherwise just had Mr. Attlee and everything. It's rather different. But... there is, the trouble is, there's another thing to which you yourself have referred, that the effect of it is that the acknowledgement, because it's kind of acknowledgement, it simply makes these forces, if they haven't either been sillily assimilated by saying, as he does, that's a rather unusual excess actually, but I mean, if he doesn't just say, well, their ideals are all right, but they're the false beliefs, or something of the kind we've talked about earlier. They are simply demonised. I mean, they're simply, not demonised, that's religious, but they're simply labelled as monsters. So either the hangman or some clinical surrogate for the hangman has to deal with them. No, he's never, ever been the kind of fatuous liberal who thought that you could do a lot of things without employing a hangman. I mean, he doesn't think that somehow, he doesn't subscribe to some Shavian or other rubbish. Effectively all went round being frightfully nice to everybody and have the right system of education and everybody psychoanalyzed or something. It would all be hunky-dory. He never thought that. But the trouble is that you've got the course of human history, intelligible in its variety, though with much local, and rightly pointed out by Herder, variety, Vico Herder, variety in various places, but based on universal human, etc., passions expressed in different ways, I think, etc. But as it were, it's punctuated by monsters who break out or turn up But that, you see, is one of the unacceptable, by others, unacceptable, and incidentally, in that case, unacceptable to him, schemas over the Holocaust.
Yes.
That it's simply...
He doesn't want to call them honest monsters. He wants to call them rational human beings with whom we can have a conversation.
Yes.
Have, unfortunately, empirically incorrect views about Jews, gypsies... Half of the human race.
Well, he does when he gets into that state, which is a bit extreme even for him, I think. But the reason for that, and we've already been that, the reason is that he can't use the simple monster model in that case because of all the requirements he has about how to think about the Jews.
Yes.
So that excludes the simple monster case there,
yes.
I think, because it's too close, you see, to a demonising explanation which would make the Jews... too special, or something like in that area.
Yes.
But there is a demonite. You see, I think the sheer monster view, it's exclusionary. It's acknowledgement, but it excludes. What it's saying is, life is like this. There are monsters. You have to face the monsters. You can't eliminate monsters. Monsters have to be eliminated by human action, human institutions. Be prepared to eliminate monsters, he says. Now, the thing about that is that the negativity has been externalised. We've got...
Non-human,
exactly. So we have the gesunde Menschenverstand, which is expresses itself in all these culturally various ways. We have the non-human, the beast, the external. Now, of course, there is an enormous literature on this subject of the kind that he precisely isn't interested in reading. I mean...
Which would be the most illuminating on this matter?
Precisely. I mean, it's certain views of the Frankfurt School, certain post-structuralist critics and others who write... Well, we don't even have to go as far as that. But, for instance, if I was thinking of my... some people I know who, you know... For instance, a lot of very recent work on colonialism, the view of the other in colonialism, the figure of Caliban. And a lot of writing about Shakespeare and the treatment of the native or the other in studies of racism, literary and historical and so on, the conceptualization of racism in terms of otherness. This seems to be exactly the sort of thing which is relevant here, which is...
The conclusion of which would be human only to human.
Yeah, that's right, exactly. Exactly. And, of course, the very business of... that it's itself a human reaction, you see, that he himself is doing, which is to externalise, stigmatise, make into a thing, make into a beast, like Caliban. And the odd way, he's doing it to those people themselves,
yes.
In a very gentle way.
Yes. But isn't, I mean, again, I may be going round the houses in a slightly tedious way over this, but it does seem important to... at least to me, to understand.
Yeah.
I was very struck when I did the interview that how much he was straining to produce an account of the Nazis which would say precisely human to human, which would say no, not monsters, beasts, and then produce what you regard as silliness, which is these were just normal,
yes.
Calculative, rational human,
yes.
Beings. And if there's silliness, it seems, in fact, to lurch... It's a kind of uncertain lurch between wanting to simply read them out of the common human species,
yes.
In order to preserve a slightly sunny estimate of human nature, and on the other hand, a much more troubled sense that when someone like Stuart Hampshire, and that's his hobby horse here, would say, oh, we're dealing with evil. He doesn't want to take that road precisely because he thinks that then leads to a demonization which
allows
the mind to shut down.
No, that's quite right. Yes, I do see what you're saying, but I think that the thing is that this is something about how long you go on. It seems to me that there are two things. One is that he will go on as long as he can, even at the cost of sinners, to recruit residual or recalcitrant phenomena into humanity, and into a humanity which is, let's not necessarily sunny, but let's call it positively comprehensible. That is,
yes.
That what I mean by positively comprehensible can be comprehensibly related to what he and you and I would call positive values. I mean, there's a list of positive values, and of course, it's what he's always interested in is the conflict between positive values, and that's the thing.
Among positive values.
That's exactly. That's what's most interesting in many ways. Okay, so he goes on as long as he can to comprehensively assimilate some recalcitrant human phenomenon to positive human values, even at the cost of a certain silliness, by explaining that it is actually positive human values, but with some false empirical things. Okay. The question is, what happens when he gives up doing that? Now, the category of evil plays no part, partly because it isn't secular, and therefore has, it sounds like, Judaism calling. Yeah. And secondly, for a very good reason, which I absolutely agree with him about, namely that those who invoke evil always invoke it too soon. That is, it's a denial of this very process of trying to understand, and it's taking refuge in what the great Jewish philosopher called the asylum of ignorance, Spinoza's phrase. I mean, it didn't apply quite to that, but it's a great Spinozan phrase that it's taking refuge in the asylum of ignorance, calling it evil. And of course, most disgusting of all is sort of facile journalistic invocations of evil by, as it were, Steiner, or I mention again Scruton, because he's obviously the former head, and this is just disgusting, and that sort of stuff. But when, so all power to Isaiah, and as it were, going on for as long as possible, and not slinking off into the asylum of ignorance labelled evil. But when he gets to the end, when really he's defeated of comprehensively assimilating the recalcitrant to the positively valuable, he then reaches for the category of the monstrous, the unassimilable. And the monstrous just means the unassimilable. And then they're mad or they're destroyed, you know, or something. But the point is, he also loses interest.
Yes.
I mean, when he was always interested as long as it could be associated to positive human values.
Yes.
Fascinated.
Yes.
When he gets to the end of that process, even he runs out of gas. We pull down the shutter and the shutter's just got monster written on it, really. I mean, end of subject.
Yes.
Just as somebody might, you could imagine some paleo-ontologist who's only interested in hominids, and as long as they're hominids, and he tries as far as possible to make them homo something, and as soon as he's agreed that Australopithecus was a monkey, he just, oh, forget about it, animals. I think that's how it works.
Okay.
But well, the trouble, of course, you and I, or others of a blacker, even if in my case perhaps slightly more facilely black temperament, would say that all the time you were looking at the human and assimilation to the human, you'd have to be assimilating to negative human values as well.
Well, what then follows from all that we've said about the Nazi case for this relativism, pluralism,
yes,
distinction? I mean, in what sense,
yes,
does it hold up? What are the criticisms to which it must now be subject, given what we've said?
Well, I think relativism and pluralism really are two different subjects. I mean, I do regard relativism as a historical, largely, either historic, since the colonialist applications of it are, or the ethnographic, synchronic ethnographic applications of it are over, except for what is actually a totally mirror image, I mean, opposite cause, namely whether we should intervene on behalf of preserving alien cultures, which is not a relativist view. It's a non-relativist view that it's a good idea to preserve variety. Which is a different matter. It has to be, because it's a matter of power. I mean, it's now a question of how we use our power or try to prevent other people's power. Since the ethnographic case is over, it seems it's a matter of historical interpretation, really. Relativism. And I think Isaiah has always been curiously ambivalent about that. Curiously ambivalent about it. I mean, I think there's a lot of his interests in the variety of human life and Herderism and all that, all plays into a certain relativist tendency, because he's just interested in them as phenomena. But I think what's supposed to save it from real relativism is the common human passions bit.
Yes.
I think.
Yes.
I think that's the idea. Now, pluralism is something else, however, it seems to me, and we've all got a problem about that, because since it's a feature of modern societies to be pluralistic, and there are many, to use Rawls's phrases, many conceptions of the good around, and whether we're just concerned with the framework in which they flourish and so on. I think Isaiah hasn't. I don't think, in a way, he's really quite discussed that problem in that form. Do you think?
Well, I'm just...
You see, I think, for instance, well, let me put it this way. I think pluralism, in as refer to the Rawlsian problem, because he's formulated in a particularly striking and influential manner, is a problem, it's a social problem. It's a problem about the existence of communities within a community. They need not be geographically continuous subdivisions. I mean, they may be born-again Christians, and they're geographically dispersed, but they are a community within a community.
Yes.
Okay? Now, I think Isaiah has thought less about the question of running a community in which different values are represented by, in this sense, different communities, than the conflict of communities, conflict of values within one person.
Yes.
It seems to me that his major influence, his major concentrations have been the two of A, where the emphasis on the values are historically dispersed, and, as it were, you have a society which is tremendously concerned with the recognisable human values of heroism rather than equality, or aristocratic freedom rather than equality, or bourgeois industry, and so on and so forth. I mean, historical explanation about the terms of history of ideas comes in there. That's the, as it were, classical relativist problem, but one to which he, of course, doesn't want to and doesn't have to give a relative answer, really, relativist answer. He can say there are fundamental human values. Some of them are stressed more in some communities than in others, but we can assimilate them to our own view because they come back to positive values we've got.
Yes.
And as I said in that introduction, of course, there is the interesting idea, which is always playing in the background, is modern liberalism actually, in a way, a higher standpoint because it recognises the plurality of all these. It's kind of sort of leftover Hegelian thought, in a way.
Yeah. Which I think is what's very interesting about that introduction, because I think that is what's going on. I do think that is.
I think he does think that.
He does think
that. And there's actually, the paradox exists also in Rawls.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Because Rawls thinks that the theory of justice is concerned with that virtue which enables you to run a pluralist society.
Yes.
He also thinks it's the highest moral capacity. So presumably, that society which most calls on the highest moral capacity must pro tanto be the best society, and therefore the pluralist society is the best society.
Yes, call that to Ayatollah Khomeini.
Exactly. And indeed, Jack doesn't really quite want to say that. It's just a consequence. And it's an interesting Kantian consequence, actually. But or quasi-Kantian consequence. But Isaiah, I think, does think that. But now... he has two fields, as it were. There's the relativist one, where the values are dispersed through history, but they are non-relativist for the reasons we've discussed. And there's a case where they're in the breast of the liberal.
Yes.
And above all, in the liberal, he loves cases also because he likes spontaneity, particularly of an artistically representing guy. He loves spontaneity. That's one of his most engaging features, of course, is that unlike many, quite a lot of liberals, of a modern kind anyway, and still less like many of the Oxford parochialists with whom he's spent perhaps rather more time than would have been a good idea. He likes absolutely genuine human spontaneity, and that's why he likes a certain kind of opera, above all Verdi. I mean, that's why Verdi is the great embodiment of the human gesture, human expression, absolute strength, and the naivety of which he spoke. I mean, you might think that quality was rather present also in the works of Wagner, but not for him. He thinks it's all, what he doesn't like, contrived. He thinks in some ways it's been thought out, that there's a very odd... Well, of course it's true, but it's not exactly the thought that Wagner's works overwhelmingly convey to those who love them, but still, though it does seem...
But where does the spontaneity argument play into what you say?
The spontaneity part, sorry, I was rambling in an Isaiah-like, loop-like manner, in the following way. He's interested in the conflict of values in the breast.
Right.
Now, there are two ways that can show up. One is the spontaneous case. That is where the conflict is an unreflective, pluralist person or even he doesn't have to be all that pluralist, he just has to be in a well-known human situation of different calls, so that a Verdian hero finds himself divided between his loyalty to country and his loyalty to his daughter or something. Now, that the great thing about that is it's unreflective. He simply feels the one thing and he feels the other thing and he has to live it through. And because there's such a thing as noble, decent connection with one's values, and the great quality there is that the not that the result has been thought out or rationalised or represented by some scale of canon of arguments, but that it's truthful. And of course that's one of the things where I absolutely sympathise with him. I mean, the partly because of his interest in Romanticism, his scepticism about the powers of rational reorganisation or representation of these things seems to be absolutely correct. And the one of the most...
You see the mark of that in your own philosophy.
Well, I mean, he and I would agree on that. And of course, that's why those are the things he likes in my philosophy, really, because he thinks it represents in a slightly more technically worked over way something which he finds very sympathetic and which, obviously, in some degree, I may have even derived from him, an emphasis on these things. Now, his... Of course, the thing is, however, that, of course, his attachment, what you were referring to just now, to modern, the secret thought that modern liberalism does actually represent the higher standpoint because it makes conscious what has always been true.
Yes.
You see, the chap I just talked about probably hasn't got, well, he certainly hasn't got a full reflective consciousness of it, in a certain way isn't even conscious about the underlying truths of pluralism.
Yes.
In a way, the very way he experiences his spontaneous conflict is not of the same order as that, and he's certainly not like some Rawlsian agent who's whizzing back to the original position and deciding whether all patriotic persons should put patriotism before it. Sort of going through some ghastly Kantian calculation, you see, of a reflective character, because he hasn't even got the requirement for that, namely the thought, I've got the values of patriotism. And he doesn't have that thought. What he thinks is,
what am I going to do?
Italia, mia figlia. I mean, that's what he has. And that's how they're represented in him.
Yeah.
And